In the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, amen. Direct, O Lord, all our actions by thy holy inspirations and carry them on by thy gracious assistance, so that every prayer and work of ours may begin from thee and by thee, having them through Christ our Lord.
Amen.
Our Lady of Divine Grace, pray for us. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, amen. This conference, of course, is on state in life, specifically family, which means there's different aspects of that. So if you're in a family, family life. Actually, probably the more specifically would be marriage and the things within the confines of marriage. In marriage, there are several different considerations regarding our duties according to our state in life. Marriage is twofold. First, just a little bit of theology behind it. In relationship to marriage, there's two aspects to it that need sorting out first. The first is the natural law, or the natural structure that God built into marriage. And its primary end, of course, is children. So that means, according to your state in life, it's all going to revolve around the things that the couple would have in relationship to their children. Then the marriage of the sacrament, in relationship to the sacrament, the end of the sacrament of matrimony is not children. That's a common misunderstanding. It's actually the salvation of the two involved. So, obviously, in order that the sacrament builds upon the natural law, so you still have this primary end in relationship to children, in relationship to the natural law structure of marriage. So this means that those who are in the sacrament of matrimony, their primary obligation and duties of state in life is to do what is ever necessary to help each other to save their souls. That's their primary end in relationship to how everything that they do, even in relationship to the children. That's their primary goal. And this is something to kind of keep in mind. So when you're talking about a state in life in marriage, you're talking about somebody who's under a contract in marriage in which body rights have been exchanged. Okay, that contract, and you've heard me say this, the term covenant is just a different, it's just a form of a contract. It's not, it might have certain nuances that are a little bit different to it, but it's not somehow completely different from a contract which has been made out in certain modern theological circles. Okay, I'm just mentioning the tradition of it. In relationship to marriage, then obviously every time you're in a state, there are certain duties that are required in relationship to your state in life. So in marriage, because of the nature of the marriage contract, they used to always break it down into what they call bed and board in English. And so this is basically pretty straightforward. Bed basically means that once the bodily rights are exchanged, that one of the spouses has a right to ask for the marital debt, and the other person has an obligation gravely, it's a grave obligation, to render the marital debt, unless there's grave reason to the contrary. Okay, and there can be legitimate grave reasons to the contrary. Obviously, we're talking about in the order of justice. So this is all in the order of justice. In the order of charity, however, the charity is going to govern ultimately when they would ask for that marital debt, under what circumstances and things of that sort. Okay, so then, of course, then there's the board. By the way, the bed also refers, there's a couple of things that this refers to. It means that a wife has a right, in fact, the word, before we go into this, the word matrimony comes from the word mater munus, which means literally the office of motherhood or the office of the mother. And so it basically means that matrimony is really all about making a woman into a mother. That's what they used to say historically. Okay, that being the case, the justice part in relationship with that is that the mother has a right for the husband to render the marital debt so that she can become a mother. This is one of the reasons why if he is to use something like contraception or she is, there's a violation of justice in relationship to the two. Okay. John Paul II talks about that, but in a slightly different way. Okay, this also means in relationship to the husband that he has a right to have children with his wife. So, and this is important because this means, like, for example, the government can't step in and say you can only have one child. That's not the nature of it. This is a natural structure that supersedes the state's rights and their ability to make any statements. Okay. This has to do with that. So that also means that, we'll see about this in a little bit later, that the husband has a right that the wife fulfill her duties in relationship to the children, and also in relationship to this husband in relationship to the wife and children, which we'll see here in just a little minute. Board means this is cohabitation. You actually live together. Cohabitation. The church says that when you're married, you have an obligation to live under the same roof. And it's only for grave causes can you be separated for any length of time. Now, this is why, for example, if somebody goes off, if it's more than 3 to 4 weeks, the new code of canon law still requires that they have to have permission of their pastor in order to be separated from their wife for that length of time. Okay, if I'm not mistaken. But I know historically that was always the case. So you have an obligation to live together. Now, this cohabitation means also that here we're not talking just about the fact that you live under the same roof, but you have a right to be treated civilly by each other. You have, in relationship to the sacrament of matrimony, that you should be treating each other with charity on a regular basis, etc. Okay. The board also meant two things in relationship to the father. It meant that he had a right that the wife would fulfill her duties according to what's called natural delegation. What does that mean? It's clear to all of us who have any semblance of rationality that men and women are just different. All right? Okay. Now, I know modern psychologists say, well, there's no difference. You know, their brains are completely the same. Of course, then they did brain studies and found out that the wiring in women's brains and men's brains are completely different. The size of certain parts of their brains are different. Women have a larger part of the speech center, and that's obvious for two reasons. One, women like to talk more. Women actually get 10 times more pleasure out of talking than men do in their brain. Why? Because it's ordered toward children. It's necessary. It's a perfection, ironically, for the children. Now, it's not meant for her husband, right? It's meant for the children. Okay. Now, it doesn't mean that she can't use that to facilitate proper communication in marriage. That's not what I'm talking about. But it means that it's ordered towards, because they also know if you don't talk to children regularly, on a regular basis, it's when before the age of 2 or 3, they won't develop the proper skills, or by 5, they won't develop the proper speech skills. So they've had cases where kids were isolated until they were like 10 or 11 years of age. They were never really talked to. The kid never developed speech. So when they started to teach the kid to speak, they found out that the kid's wiring in the brain, there were certain parts of grammar that the kid could never properly grasp or understand or make proper use of because the wiring had already solidified and it was unable to process that stuff. So usually in the area of like definite articles and things of this sort. We should have kind of already known that a little bit because there's certain languages that don't have use of definite articles. And as a result of that, when they learn English, for example, they're all over the map when it comes to the definite and indefinite articles. They don't have a clue how they work, right? Okay, so this natural delegation means that because of the structure that God built into feminine psychology and biology, that women are simply designed, there's certain perfections that women have that they're ordered towards as a result of this. So, for example, women just have a much better grasp, as a general rule, on how to arrange things within the home. It's called the nesting principle. Women will just simply start arranging it, right? And so recently, a friend of mine was asking me all sorts of questions about, should I have this for my son, and this for my son, and this for my son? And like, the kid isn't born yet. Your wife should be asking me these questions, not you. All right, anyway. I would understand he just really wanted to be a good father. But the point is that women have just a general sense about how things are arranged. Part of that is because women have a greater inclination to the virtue of modesty as a general rule, not necessarily in speech, but at least in dress and also in comportment. That means that women have a general, because women were designed to be more concerned about their appearance, which we talked about, I think, at a prior time, they have a better sense of decorum, how certain things fit together and when they don't fit together, right? So I'm always nervous when you get these guys who are interior decorators. There's always something a little off, right? So whereas women have that kind of that natural capacity to kind of see how these things. Now, ultimately, it's true that the father is the head of the whole. He's responsible for everything in the home, everything, literally everything. But by natural delegation, because God designed women to be better at certain things than men, as a general rule, again, that means that it's God's intention that they do these specific things, and so this is part of her duties. Unless there's some reason she can't fulfill it, then the father should fulfill it. But this means that the husband, or the father, has a right that the wife fulfill those duties. Now, that essentially means that the husband has a right, a natural right, and it's a grave one, for the wife to stay home with the children, as long as there's children at home, and even to stay home to take care of the home in general. That's his right, okay? That doesn't mean that she couldn't necessarily do some limited work outside the home when there's no children there, or if it becomes necessary, by necessary I mean gravely so, she may have to work outside the home, but that's because of the fact that there's some kind of failing on the side of St. Thomas says there's a failing on the side of the masculine side, but he's not talking about failing necessarily morally. He's just saying you might live in a culture where both, just to survive, both may have to work, but normally speaking, that should not be the case, and society has an obligation to structure it that way. Which brings up a very important point. This means that part of their duties is to, we'll talk about this a little bit later too, is to bring children up to the age of majority. And so that means that by the time a person reaches the age of 18, I think you've heard me say this, by the time they reach the age of 18, they should be able to step out of their home and live completely on their own without any kind of major issues. So that's something that's the goal of the parents. Okay. The next one is, in relationship to the mother, she has a right because of the fact, oh, by the way, God punished Eve and said, your punishment shall be that you shall bear children in pain, and you'll raise them, and that'll also cause you pain. Okay, so basically what this means is that God intended for the wife, as a general rule, to stay home with the children, as a general rule. The father, again, has that right. If he's providing everything for him, then he has a right for her to stay home. This is a grave right. This is why I tell people, if a woman is working outside the home without sufficient cause, while children under the age of reason are home, it's grave matter. Because he has this right, and the children also have this right. The children need the mother at home in order to begin that, to come to full maturation, virtue, etc., by the time they reach the age of 18. And when the wife isn't there, God can provide where nature is lacking, but as a general rule, when the wife isn't there due to some type of neglect of her duties because she wants to have a career or whatever the case is, which, by the way, I've never understand why women wanted a career for this reason. God gave the punishment of working to Adam. So I often tell women, why do you want the punishment for women and the punishment for Adam? Why don't you just stick to your own punishment and not carry on any more than you have to? All right. Okay, that all being said. The other thing I think that is part and parcel of our culture today is the failure to grasp the value of women's place in the home. The fact of the matter is that this is something that we're seeing in spades. Our culture is just getting goofy and kids are a mess and all sorts of reason, but I'll mention this. I think I might have mentioned this at another time, but there was a psychologist that I work with from time to time to do some consultation with her, and she told me that one of the things she was doing was doing an analysis of why these kids were walking into places like McDonald's and schools and mowing people down with machine guns. Why were they doing this? And she said the only thing that she found that they had in common is that they had gone to daycares. And the only thing she could figure is that they were suffering from disaffective disorder, which is the inability to emotionally connect with people. This is one of the reasons why women have a stronger emotional life, is because the first 5 years are absolutely crucial for people to be able to develop those abilities to connect with people emotionally. And if they don't develop within those first 5 years, it's pretty much over. Right? Mm-hmm. So this is one of the reasons why it's so crucial for women to stay at home. Two, you've heard me say that line from G.K. Chesterton, which I've always liked. He said, he could never understand why women wanted to vote. Now, women voting is a whole other topic, which I'd be happy to talk about at some other point. But He said, I can't understand why women would want the vote. He said, because a woman's vote, if she votes, doesn't mean anything. Its impact on society is negligible. Whereas she can make or break a nation by the way she raises a single child. The impact that women have on the structure of society just by how they raise children is so absolutely crucial. And that's all being forgotten. Of course, this is all the product of the communists, which you can read that in the, or listen to that in my other homily on women in the natural order. Okay. The mother has a right, therefore, because her duties are consummate with her natural delegation, the mother has a right to stay home with the children, unless there's grave cause. This is something that I think is important, because a lot of times guys are trying to push their wives out into the workforce. And the wife has a right to stay home with the children. She has a right to stay there. Okay. The only time that she would have to put that right aside is if there was some grave cause, like they were going to lose the house or the children were starving or something of that sort, not to get another boat or the next car, but in order to have what's necessary. These are those means that that's their duty. So that means on the side of the father, he has an obligation, therefore, to provide for them. Both in two ways. One, materially. He has an obligation to go out and get a job and to actually to be able to provide for his family. This is why historically in the past they would tell people, look, you can't marry, you can't assume the essential obligations. They would say this to a man, you can't assume the essential obligation of marriage of supporting your wife if you don't have a job or if you don't have an adequate job, right? Okay, so he has to be able to provide for them materially. This is one of the problems with the way our culture is structured, and I think you might have heard me say this before, but I'll mention it again. If you look at the way nature is structured, people go through puberty, it varies. Obviously, women go through it slightly earlier than men. And they go through puberty, so by the time they're somewhere between 12 and 14, they've gone through puberty. Then you need about 2 to 3 years of maturation, of emotional maturation, in order to build a sufficient virtue so that you can actually have go out and get married and have children. Okay, that's the way it's structured. So the way it looks is that most women should be able to marry sometime between the ages of 17 and 19. Most men, it's delayed a year. It should basically, because of certain reasons, St. Thomas gives a bunch of them, but the point is that it should basically, he should come to the point where he can support a family or have everything in place between the ages of 18 and 20 years of age, 18 to 19. So the marrying time should be roughly about the same. This structure that is in nature that we see means that the inclinations towards the marital debt are in place at that point, so that barring some kind of grace, the fact of the matter is that that's when people should be marrying as a general rule. Our culture is structured in a way in two ways that delay that. One, financially, because we have not set it up so that people will have adequate education by the time they reach the age of 18. Why? Because high schools, as a general rule, most people are clueless by the time they finish high school and they haven't learned a thing in 4 years. What they have learned isn't adequate. Historically, during the medieval period, people actually started college at 14. You were done with your bachelor's at 18. There was none of this playing around and messing around. Today, people go to college and it's just an extension of high school for another 4 years where they don't hardly do anything. And they get out the other end, they got this piece of paper so they can go work. The problem is that it's delaying that process, and then we wonder why there's such a problem of the Sixth Commandment right now. Okay. We've delayed the financial ability for a man to support his family. That's a serious problem. This is also one of the reasons why I've been trying to push guys into the trades more and basically say, look, if you only go to college if you want to do something like be a doctor or a lawyer or something that's a specific profession. Otherwise, don't go to college, go into a trade. Okay. The second thing is, part of that also has to do with the whole debt thing, but the other part of it is, too, is that we've delayed the maturation process, which you've heard me talk about before, too. The maturation process today, because we allow boys to basically be irresponsible, because they don't have to do anything which shows that they can actually provide for anybody, you know, they don't take responsibility for something, do a job right and make sure it's done right, etc. They usually don't contribute to anything in the home. They're just sitting around watching TV and eating all day long or playing on the games, etc. As a result of that, it's actually basically by the time they reach the age of 18, they're still 10 or 14 emotionally. I mean, we've talked about this before. But that means that it gets delayed, so that by the time they actually get to the point where they're actually mature enough to marry, they're somewhere between 26 and 30. And now it's getting even later. So we have a huge problem along that line. And this is not what nature had intended at all. This, in my estimation, they need to completely restructure the educational system so that most people, not all, most people would be able to support a family by the time they reach 18 to 20 years of age. And people are ready to marry at that point, okay? But he has an obligation to provide materially, but then also spiritually. As head of the household, he has to provide spiritually. He is the primary individual of providence in the family. It's his job foremost of anybody in the family to be praying the most, doing the most penance, doing those things necessary. Of course, obviously, he's got to just fulfill his duties in relationship to working, too. But outside of that, he should be the most spiritual individual in the family providing for that. That's his job, okay? This means, too, because the wife has to stay home and take care of the children. You know, I always like this, how they'll get women. I say, women can do anything a man can do. Oh, really? I used to have a pastor. He grew a mustache. And the only reason he had the mustache was whenever he would hear that from women, he would just say, grow one of these. And I told him, you better be careful, because in Italy, some of those older women can do that. Okay. But anyway, the point being is that they'll bring in, they'll have guys who can lift all these weights, right? And then they'll bring in some woman who's like 350 pounds, Tessie, comes in here, and she lifts the weights and manages to lift 200 pounds, you know, it's just, see, they can do anything a man can do. Well, yeah, but the exception proves the rule. That as a general rule, God had intended very distinct things for women because of the nature of this natural delegation that God gave to women. She's not designed to work in hard, physically intensive labor kinds of things in the same way that a man is. So, and this is not true just in physiologically, but also psychologically. As a result of that, that means that they used to call women the weaker sex. By weaker, they usually would mean physically weaker, and that's by God's design. It'd be a little weird if women had the same physiology as men, right? Okay. So the point being is that that meant that the husband also had the obligation to protect. So, and part of this is twofold again. He has to protect them materially. This means that nothing, these are his duties according to his state in life. He has an obligation to protect materially. This is why it's his place. If that some intruder comes into the house, it shouldn't be his wife who's running for the gun. It should be him. Okay. This all, and so he also has to protect the children, etc. Then it also is spiritually, but the spiritual has two components. One, he has an obligation to protect them on a moral level. It's his place to keep all the morally bad things out of the house. Now, the wife has this obligation too, but it's ultimately his responsibility, and she's just basically there assisting him because she's his helper, not his slave, as I mentioned, helper. It's his place to help, her place to help morally. She's usually going to be the one that's going to give the primary moral formation. That's true. But he's it's his place to protect the children morally. And that means even from themselves. So when they act up and do stupid things, it's ultimately his place to make sure that that the kids behave. My father, my mom was one of those moms that if she just says, wait till your father gets home, that was it. I mean, you just complied. Because my father, even though my father was a very meek man in a certain sense. He rarely got angry. When he got angry, he got angry. But when he didn't, he didn't give that angry. But when we were in, for example, when we were in Mass, during Mass, when we were little kids, all it took, there was one thing we feared, and this is what kept us being very pious at Mass, and that was my father's middle knuckle. Because if you started acting up, it was just boom, right on the top of the head, right here. Boom, you're just like, right? So that's all it took, right? And it's the same thing with my father. They know through psychological studies that the deeper voice carries more weight to it, and as a result, it comes across more authoritative. This is why the father can, it's easier for the father, both because it's his physiology and his ability, his speech, everything. It's easier for him. He carries more force authoritatively, and as a result of that, it's easier for him to impose certain things. I've heard women complain, you know, the kids won't let obey me, but as soon as the father comes home, then they'll do what they're supposed to do. Okay, that's just part of psychology. Now, it's fallen psychology. Granted, children should just obey their mother too, because she's actually fulfilling the duties of the she's helping the father fulfill his duties. Because he's the one responsible for all this, she's the helper so that this gets accomplished, and so when you disobey your mother, you're also disobeying your father. It's that simple. Okay. The next one is also spiritually in the sense of demonic. It's his place to keep the demons out of everybody's hair. Okay. And his authority as the father also means his ability to command them is far more powerful than even the wife's, to a certain degree. Okay. So these are their duties. They have to do all of this. There will be certain aspects that are fluid. So, for example, some people will say only the husband should have anything to do with the finances. I don't think that's necessarily true. Some will say, you know, the husband should make the money, and the wife should have everything to do with the finances, just take care of the finances. I don't think that's true either. It's fluid based upon those particular things. Ultimately, the responsibility is the husband's. But the husband can delegate or just say, here, you take care of these things because I don't want to deal with them or what have you. So there can be a certain fluidity on certain things. On other things, there is no fluidity. By the way, because the father and the husband's job is to provide and protect for the children, it means that the wife and the children have a right to be provided for and protected in all of these different ways. So this is where the rights become part of our duties, that we have to do certain things. Usually neglect sets in because of the fact that some of these duties are difficult. So, for example, one of the things that you're seeing among the millennials right now is they don't want to work. Right? Even the boys are particularly bad, they don't want to work at all. And they want their wife to go out and work, so they don't have to work as much. You know, when my parents grew up, the father's understanding or the husband's understanding of his obligation to provide for the family was so ingrained in them that at one point my father actually worked 3 jobs to provide for his family so that my mom could stay at home. 3 jobs. Today, most guys, I've actually heard a guy from that generation say, I'm only working 40 hours. If we don't have enough money, you're going to have to go out and work. So this is a bit of a problem. Okay, then, this, by the way, the father has a right because the father, his duty is to determine the cult of the family, which basically means how the religious practices are to be executed. It's his place to make those final determinations. The wife can make suggestions, but it's ultimately his ability, it's his things that can make those, that obligate, it's his place to make those determinations. Now, very often what happens is, okay, so this is the structure of the thing. How does it end up going awry? Well, it goes awry in 2 ways. One, in which we talked about, and I think in one of our conferences in the past, we talked about the fact that men, because of the curse of Adam, tend to be irresponsible and effeminate. And they don't come up to speed in relationship to these things because doing these things is difficult and hard. So that's one of the things that ends up causing it. On the side of women, we talked a little bit about this already, but it basically has to do with the curse of Eve. Which the curse of Eve, the structure of the curse of Eve is threefold in relationship to that. So if you want to know about the problem of men, you can listen to the conference on how to raise a man that you see with men. With women, the curse of Eve is essentially has 3 components to it. The first is she has a greater desire for marriage. Your desire shall be for your husband. Now, this means that as a general rule, it's harder for women to live independently than men. It's easier for a guy to be a bachelor, I think, than for a woman to be a bachelorette, okay? The second thing is that in Hebrew, you've heard me talk about this, it means the desire to control. This control then has a secondary component that's connected to it, and that has to do with the way in which Eve ended up falling and what happened afterwards. So Eve takes it upon herself to eat the fruit, which means that she trusted her own judgment and she trusted the emotional delight that she was getting out of looking at the fruit and her judgment about that over and above her husband's possible judgment about what was supposed to be done. So as a result of that, women very often have this idea that they see things, they know what's right more than their husbands. Okay. So it has to do with their judgment, they think is better than their husbands, as a general rule. Then, after the fall, what happens? Well, Adam eats the fruit, which means he didn't have good judgment either. But then what ends up happening is that she looks at him, and because it's his sin that affects the children, she looks at him and thinks that he can't do anything right. So, I'm sure you've heard that joke, you know, when I got married, he was Mr. Right. 5 years after marriage, I realized he couldn't do anything right. Okay, this is a structure that is the result of the sin of Eve. These two, primarily these two, have to be conquered because these are the ones that cause two things. One, for a woman to ultimately neglect her duties. She's so focused on what she thinks is the right thing to do very often, or that her husband just doesn't see what the issue is, that she's not tending to her own things that she should be focusing on. The second thing is that the control is directly contrary to the husband's headship. And so that's something that, and it's not just in matters of externals, although that's the primary thing, because, guess what? The children, because the father is the head of the household, the children have a right to be governed according to that specific structure. And therefore, they actually have a right. Both the husband has a right that he's not trying to be controlled, and the children have a right that the wife not control the husband, and that she not control their upbringing, except insofar as it is subordinate to his. Second, it primarily has to do with the internals. What does this mean? The principal thing, one of the principal things that every saint accomplishes in the course of their becoming holy is an inherent distrust in their own judgment. That means that even their emotional life comes into congruity with that distrust, so that they would much rather rely on an external source who has a proper authority telling them what to do than them following their own judgment about a particular matter. This is a very key thing because it means, and this is true even of men, because men have to do what? They have to rely on the church or a spiritual director or whatever. But this means that the wife will never reach sanctity if she's just doing it externally, that ain't good enough. She has to master this internally, which means she has to get to the point where she realizes that what? Her judgment can easily be affected by her increased emotional life, which, by the way, her judgment is affected because part of the curse of Eve, the fathers of the church say, is that her emotional life is less controlled because there's more of it, and it's more integrated into her psychology for the sake of the children, which is a good thing, but because of original sin, most of the good stuff has now gone awry. And so her emotions are more likely to affect her judgment. The second thing is that because of this whole curse of Eve where she tends to trust her own judgment and see the faults of her husband, then what ends up happening is that she, from that, then you get this reciprocal thing is then she thinks she's got to control the guy. Right, okay. But she will never reach sanctity until she conquers that desire to control. All right. In religious life with women, that desire to control is conquered through obedience. Okay. And this is something that's really important, because in the end, even people who are under religious vows have to trust the judgment of their superiors to some degree, right? They just have to say, you know, if they don't know why, but he's telling me to go out and water the plants, I go out and water the plants, right? I just do it. Okay. This is something that is absolutely key, because it's this moderated, her understanding of this moderation in her judgment, and then as a result of this will usually fall into place. When children see that the wife is not trying to control her husband or trying to control them, there is a specific virtue that they see in their mother that automatically endears them, and the same with the husband, and that's modesty. Specifically, decorum. They see how her interior life and how everything she's doing fits so perfectly the circumstances. In modern English, modern, we don't use this term much anymore, we used to call this grace. That women had a certain grace, these women who had this under control had a certain grace about them. There was a certain kind of perfection and manifestation. So, okay. So what's this all got to do with children then? What's their state in life? It's to be abused. No, okay. because the child, according to their state in life, because children, especially in the beginning, don't have the proper formation, their proper state in life, their duties of state in life is principally obedience until they reach the age of majority. Okay. And then also, but they also have the obligation of preparing themselves or cooperating with that preparation to get them to the point of to where they can actually do what they need to do at when they reach the age of 18. So children neglect their duties when they're neglecting their studies, when they're told, look, you need to study this, when they're neglecting the legitimate commands of their parents, go out and do this work, when they're neglecting working on specific virtues, when they know they're supposed to have them. That's their duty. Why? Because their duty, their state in life is what? A state of imperfection, and their goal is perfection. So that by perfection, we mean in the order of maturation, both physically and psychologically and morally. So that means that by the time they reach 18, they should have sufficient virtues in all the areas in order to enter into marriage, which I mentioned before. So that's their principle according to their duties, their state in life. The difficulty is when we go through puberty, there's a deepening of self-reflection and a grasping of the moral principles to some degree. And the problem is that the emotional life also increases, and so this brings up a particular point, and this also applies to men and women, but it's something that women have to keep in mind, because I know there's certain women who have mastered that internal state, and they just say, look, when I start getting emotional, I know now is not the time to start talking, I just shut down until I get this thing under control, right? Okay, but that has to do with the fact that our intellect, when it makes a judgment, goes back to the image, and if that image is affected by the emotion, then what ends up happening is that my judgment in relationship to what the actual circumstances are, the situation, is compromised. The problem is, in order to have good judgment, two things are necessary. One, you have to have a clear image. Now, this means in order to know what the prudent thing is to do, you have to have it has to be disimpassioned, not emotional. So the second thing is that you have to have a series of memories by which to properly prepare the image for. The reason young people are very often imprudent is because of the fact that they don't have the sufficient memories in order to prepare the proper images for right judgments. Second of all, then they need habits of judgment specifically in relationship to the moral principles. They need to know which principles apply here and now. But when you're first coming out of the gate after puberty, you don't really understand how these things work. You might understand the precepts, you know, like don't lie and don't steal and things of that sort. But the principles, in order to judge them in the concrete, requires all this to come together, and that's not sufficiently developed until a person reaches a certain age. This is why I said there has to be a 2 to a 3 year maturation period for all this to come into place, in order so that there's virtues and emotions and the right memories are being done, there's proper habits of judgment, so that when a person reaches a certain stage, they've got it together. So, and is this possible at 18? Oh yeah, absolutely, I've seen them before. They're just very, very rare these days. Okay. So this means that in all of this, that why do children end up saying being disobedient? Because A, they don't understand the principles well, very often. But B, their emotion, St. Thomas says, I love this line. St. Thomas says, emotions affect our judgment by making us, when we look at the image, we tend to think that the thing is worse than it is or better than it actually is, but not as it is. And so it's not until there's sufficient virtue in the emotions do you have sufficiently clear images to see things as they actually are. And this is something, this is why children have to just be patient. When they start coming through, when they go through puberty, the images are increased, they have greater clarity in their imagery, etc. But they still don't have the habits and everything sufficiently developed and the proper habits of judgment developed in order to do this. And this is why they have to shift, parents have to shift from counsel to command, because habits are voluntary. The child has to be developing them on their own. In the beginning stages, you just have to tell them, you do X. It's all command. And that's to build up the proper associations and patterns of behavior. But then as they go through puberty and they start understanding things and they get certain intellectual understanding of things, they can start developing that a little bit on their own, but it's not until after they go through puberty that they actually start having that fullness of that ability to develop the virtue. But that means, though, that they have to rely on counsel, because part of prudence is docility, taking counsel with people who know better. And the problem is when we're younger, we think we know everything. I'm sure you've heard that joke. Everybody's heard that joke. You know, when I was 18, my parents didn't know anything. When I was 25, I realized they had really gotten intelligent in the last 7 years, right? Okay, the point being is that it's necessary for people to be quickly fall into counsel in relationship to their parents, or follow the past counsel that their parents have given them. They have to get into that habit if they're going to act rightly. Okay, so these are this is our state in life in relationship to that. That's our duties. The last one I want to talk about just very briefly is what's called, some people call it the single state. Okay, now this is somebody who's not married or under vows of some sort. That is, they're not a religious, a priest or something of that sort, and they're not married. Okay, now, St. Thomas says that nature had intended for there's what they call the general will of God. The general will of God is that everybody gets married. That's the general will. Everybody gets married. Why do we know that? Because he designed all of us with bodies ordered towards marriage. Okay. Everybody gets married. However, the saints, of course, also say that there is also, however, the specific will of God, in which God intends, or God gives somebody a specific grace to forego the inclinations of marriage in order to have perfect service to Him. So it's something ordered towards Him. There's a specific grace. So historically, someone who is single over a certain age and wasn't married yet, St. Thomas's phrase for that is in casu. Now, most people think that means in the house. No, it actually comes from cadere, which means to fall. It basically means that they're in a state or in a situation where the circumstances, he says, has failed in some way. Doesn't mean the person necessarily has, but the circumstances just hasn't provided the right mate or the right circumstances for him to enter the priesthood or what have you. So this, he says, this in casu, he says, in relationship to God is praetor intentionem. It's aside from his intention. God still intends for everybody either to get married or to enter into religious life. That is the context of his will. So when people say, well, I think God is calling me to the single state, no, don't take the fact that either you or someone else has failed or the circumstances have failed as somehow God's positive will for you. A lot of times the reason people haven't married is A, they're not mature enough. Sometimes they can't find a decent mate. I mean, that's becoming a bigger and bigger problem too, a big problem. But don't take those things to mean that somehow this is God's will. Okay. Because my basic attitude is, if a person goes to a certain stage and they're still single, they should consider entering into some type of vow of chastity or something of that sort, so that at least their life is ordered under a vow. Okay. Any questions?
Did I put everybody to sleep? Yeah.
One interesting thing when you talk about mother's role in the house, especially geared towards children, mm-hmm. as an employer, what are your responsibilities as far as having employees? Like in my field, obviously the technicians are typically women.
Yeah.
And they do have, you know, and they do have, some have children. Mm-hmm. The ones that, you know, I have one who is, she works part time.
Right.
And her schedule is geared around, you know, when she can work, when her husband works.
Yeah.
And when her child is not in daycare, but he's down in school.
Right.
In like a pre-K, so he's, you know, he works in the mornings, and they'll arrange it at times where the husband can pick the child up, or she, you know, just works a half day and goes and picks up the child.
Right.
Putting that into context, and then I have the other issue where the other women who are there, they're there all the time, and they look at this relationship that I have allowed this other young woman to be in.
Right.
And they're always complaining about, well, she always gets off early, she's never here, she's dead, you know, this. Hmm. Is there a way to combat that? that's the jealousy aspect, or
yeah.
And on the one hand, they complain when they're out of the office and they don't get a big paycheck because they didn't get paid because they didn't work. But then on the other hand, you know, they want to be off as much as
they can be.
As they can be.
Well, what that probably tells you is that their natural inclination to want to be home with their children is kind of getting to them to some degree. You know, they feel mm-hmm. guilty. A lot of women say they feel guilty when they're not home with their children. So, and I think that's probably a natural law inclination, frankly. But, you know, if you're in relationship to this, I mean, my recommendation would be, unless you cannot find another technician other than a woman. Okay, you can hire the woman if you can't find any other technician other than a woman. In other words, if there is a male who applies, it's better to give the male the job than her, ultimately. Unless there's some grave cause on her side. So, in other words, like they're about to lose their home or whatever the case is. But normally speaking, the way society should be structured is that men are given preference in relationship to jobs so that they can fulfill their duties and then women can fulfill their duties at home. Mm-hmm. And that also means, pushing women into the workforce was ultimately the communists. They were the ones who did that. And they brought it over to the United States via the feminist movement. Okay. The point being is that if you can find a man who, especially if he's got a family, and he has all the same credentials, he should really get the job because of his obligations. If she's just doing this because she wants a career and she wants to have more money and she doesn't really want to spend time with her kids because she can't stand them, then you know ultimately you give it to him, of course. So the point being is that that's the first step in just trying to hire. But once it has hired, You just have to tell people, look, the conditions of your contract or your work employment here are different than hers. So they're just different conditions. You know, if you want to go to a different set of conditions, we can sit down and talk to them or whatever. So, and you know, the other thing is I think that the society has to encourage women to stay home with their children.
Right.
That's what it has to do, both by. Unless, again, there's grave cause, making it difficult for her to work in the world without a sufficient reason. If there is, it's another matter. You know, and I think the real irony of it is, if you look at the object of work, the duty that a woman has been given, which is raising children, that's an actually higher duty than going out and working. That's what most people don't seem to grasp.
Yeah, that's true.
And so the actual keeping women at home is actually encouraging them to the higher state than running off and having a career.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's one of the things that society has to just invert this whole thing. And how do we know? How do we know too that women are designed that way? Most, I've never personally ever, I mentioned this in one of my conferences, I've never met a single woman who worked outside the home when the kids were at home that was happy. They're always miserable as a result of it. Okay. Yes.
So, you know, since marriage is supposed to be a contract, there's a typical thing with the divorce, how the contract can be dissolved by mutual agreement between the parties involved.
Yes.
So why is marriage indissoluble?
Because of you, children. St. Thomas says that according to the natural law, there's two reasons. There's a one that I'll add. There's two reasons. The first is that when you look at, St. Thomas says that when you look at the raising of children, both the wife and the husband, the father and the mother, are necessary because of the way we are designed psychologically, which obviously makes sense. Because sometimes people say, well, wait a minute, I lost my wife. What do I do now? Do I get another wife? Well, not necessarily. I'm just saying that God can provide in those particular cases. But if you're talking about just divorcing because you don't want to feel it. But the reason we know that is that, and they're seeing this in studies, when people divorce, the psychological impact on the children is grave, right? And St. Thomas says this is true even to the end of life in order to show the example to the children, to form them even after the children are gone, that this is a necessary thing, that it's ordered towards a society must order this in this manner for the sake of the children, all children, ultimately. The second reason is because psychologically, we know, for example, in my conference that I do on courtship, which I gave, just got brutalized in the audio, but in the conference that it is that when people... We know this from the psychological structure that when people go from person to person to person in their dating process, what happens is that emotionally, they go from highs to trauma, highs to trauma, highs to trauma, highs to trauma. Well, for a man to set up a situation where a woman is he's allowing the woman or set the circumstances so that the woman becomes emotionally attached to him in such a manner that there's no way to fulfill that emotional attachment, he's just going to sever it later, is inherently unjust. Now, this means, why? Because the way we are designed emotionally is that once we emotionally bond with somebody, it's to be permanent. That's the way we're structured and designed. They even know about this in relationship to chemicals in the conjugal act, how that all creates this bonding process. So we know that natural law inclined them to have this permanent, this specific kind of permanent relationship. And so it's just built into our very psychology. So it's the children and the psychology of the spouses that requires it, which the church has said that too in the past. It's necessary. And two, the other thing is that what would this mean to women? I mean, if a guy can just say, okay, the children are raised, I'm out of here, and he leaves, then she's on her own. That's unjust too. So she has a right to be supported until she's dead, basically, because of the fact that she worked in taking care of the children, which took her out of a field that could have provided for her, which she was supposed to do anyway. Yes?
When a woman is single and doesn't have a family, does she pursue what it... And she's generally clueless of what God wants her to do.
Right.
She pursue a career.
There's been a bit of fluidity in that historically. Usually, in some cultures in the past, she just stayed home and the parents put her to work. That's usually what happened historically. Because that's not necessarily the best. Because today, because of modern conveniences, and you know, it doesn't take them a whole day to do the laundry and all that kind of thing. Unless your family is gargantuan, but you know, most, in the past, you know, at the turn of the century, it would take the woman the entire Monday. That's when they used to do it historically. On Monday, the woman would spend all day Monday just doing laundry. That was it, right? Okay. So that, because that's not required anymore, and also in certain other cultures, the woman could work on a limited basis outside the home when she was single. But historically, if she worked outside the home,
she still had to be under her father's headship until then. So, which meant that historically, women under women who were not married under the age of childbearing never lived alone. And the only women who did were women of ill repute. So that's why you just didn't do it. They either lived with their family at home and they helped out around there and did work there. And by work, I mean the same amount of work as if you were working somewhere else, right? And then if they, after they reached the age of 18. Now, obviously, if you're studying in college and things like that, because I can see legitimately studying a woman going to college, not necessarily so much to have a career, but to provide the educational opportunities or to be able to provide what's necessary to do good homeschooling and things of that sort, even in a specific area, so that she wants to specialize in mathematics so that she can help other people with their kids in relationship to mathematics. But the point basically being is that that, you know, she can study those things while she's single, but if she has a vocation, then she should really be doing the preparatory work necessary in order to enter into religious life. And that may mean, because some religious places say we want you to basically have gone to college and get a certain amount of background and things of this sort first, or get a certain amount of experience in the workforce before this goes on, before you come here. That may be what you have to do. But ultimately, again, it's she's still under her father, and then her father ultimately makes the judgment about what would be considered suitable work for her. That's historically how it happened. So, which kind of gives you a sense of how off the rails our culture. I mean, if you took someone from the medieval period and started to take them here today and started explaining how men and women behave, they would just be, they would think that we were literally diabolic culture because it was so contrary to nature. Yes.
What if, say, I just wanted to know how morally wrong it would be to refuse to marry a man who is kind of proven to be a good, moral, upstanding man, but has sort of like personality issues and also is just kind of not altogether what, like, yeah. Personality that you can't really bond with very well, or personality you're not really attracted to.
Yeah, I would say don't marry him, obviously, for two reasons. One is there is a legitimate side to God designed us this way to be inclined towards the spouse that people particularly have, to have that emotional connection. I mean, that's why he designed us to have to be able to have interior psychological intimacy with another human being. Okay. And not just him. Okay. The second side of it is, so there has to be a certain element of that. I mean, you know, I joke in one of my homilies where I said, you know, I don't care how ugly she is, even if you have to put a bang over her head. If she's got virtue, you'll be happy the rest of your life. And then I'll say the opposite, you know, I don't care how ugly he is, you know, if he's got virtue, you'll be happy the rest of your life. There does still have to be some level of attraction, otherwise the marriage becomes very difficult on a basic natural level because of how we're designed as human beings, structurally, and how we emotionally connect so that we can easily work together. Okay. The other side of it, though, is that personality disorders, I would say no, because those personality disorders are going to end up affecting the children. Now, it's one thing if it's a minor, and everybody has minor personality disorders. I mean, we're all, because of our sinfulness, we all have these little quirks and things of that sort. But once we, if we're just talking about stuff that's minor, that's one thing. You just have to look at it and say, can I live with this? You know, be brutally honest with yourself. Can I live with this guy that, you know, basically, every time he goes to bed, he throws his socks over on my side of the pillow. I mean, can I live with this? You know, okay.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you're talking about something that's grave, you know, to where psychologically and emotionally he can't fully function properly, I would say then he himself is not in a position to assume the obligations of marriage. So I would say no.
Thanks.
Yes?
What is the difference between temperament and personality?
Ooh, very good. Okay. That's a pretty big... okay, temperament is a... temperament is the disposition... disposition of the matter's arrangement in your body. In other words, we see this all, everybody's DNA is different, right? So our matter is arranged differently. Now, how that matter is arranged differently determines how easily your soul can function through your body. So, for example, intelligence is simply the fact that one person's brain is better disposed to carry out certain functions, and as a result, he is simply more intelligent than another, because the soul can more easily operate through a well-disposed bodily organ. Okay, that's what a temperament is. A temperament is a specific arrangement of the matter that determines which proclivities you're going to have in relationship to which emotions are going to be easily moved, more easily moved.
So how God makes you?
Yes.
You're born.
That's correct.
With your temperament.
Is that like sanguine or melancholy?
Yeah, sanguine, melancholy, etc. Okay. Whereas personality is the product of several things. One, your temperament, because most people develop their personality along their temperament. You know, most sanguine people just become very outgoing people, right? The second thing is, it also has to do with your intellectual formation, to some degree, but it also has to do with your habits. Your personality is primarily, in human beings, determined by which habits you develop, which then incline you towards certain kinds of activity rather than others. So you can actually have somebody who might have a sanguine temperament, but because of his disposition, or because of his habits, he doesn't tend to act very much on that anymore. So, for example, people who are very sanguine who start fasting a lot will eventually get to the point where they tend to be less outgoing as a result of it, and they tend to be less, they tend not to want food and all that stuff all the time. So the personality is primarily based upon the development of the habits in two ways. One, the moral habits, so what you're inclined towards. The second one is your intellectual habits, your patterns of thinking. So your moral formation, your experience, your environment, and things like that as you grow up will fashion your personality. So personality is basically a term that we give to a person's general sense of inclinations as a result of all these factors that go into setting those inclinations up. You can read my book on psychology. You probably weren't expecting that, but that's what I talk about in my book on psychology.
Okay.
Okay, yeah.
Just looking recently at in the book of Timothy about the vocations for men and women.
Yes.
And how when Timothy says women shall gain their sanctification there through raising
children. That's right.
And so I looked at that and I thought, that is just so simple for a woman. I mean,
it is.
That today society complicates life for women.
Yeah.
As far as what's really important, and in the end, where we're supposed to be going.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And the way a man grows holiness is through his work. Obviously, also how he governs the family, but through his work primarily. How he handles that, what its relationship is to his family, etc. Obviously, this means that his work, I think you've heard me say this, but his work is there for the sake of the family, not the family for the sake of the work. And this can be one of the real problems, too, is when we have certain kinds of attachments, we can begin the process where we start sucking everybody else into the family, into the thing that we're doing in order to keep this thing going, right? And here we're putting aside something that, you know, is for sake of financial survival. You know, so like in certain places, like in certain ranches, if they had a really bad year, a lot of the kids had to come out of the schools and start working at the family ranch farms and stuff in order to financially survive. That's one thing. It's another thing if we have some kind of a pet project that we like and we're just dragging everybody into it, and then we're finding all these reasons of why this is good for everybody. So we have to be really careful in relationship to that. And guys can be very, I've seen guys that can be kind of prone to that kind of thing if they're not careful. So, that's just something you have to kind of be aware of. Okay. If you will kneel, I'll give you a blessing. Benedictio Deo omnipotentis, Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sanctus, et Manet Semper. Amen.
Amen.